Good morning. My name is Frank Veraster. I'm director of the energy program here at CSIS. The installment that we're having here this morning, and this is quite the array of panelists, is the biofuel segment of our future fuel series. And the series itself we're doing in conjunction with the Global Strategy Institute, GSI, which is part of CSIS, and also NREL, which is the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. And Doug Arendt of NREL is on my right here. Doug's going to be moderator of today's panel. They've co-sponsored the series. When we started this last fall, at least conceptually, the idea was to accomplish two things. And the first was to at least raise the education level, because there's a lot of discussion these days about alternative fuels and the contribution that they can make, and looking at the fuels choices and emerging technologies. And then secondly, in terms of the policy debate, since we are here in Washington, we wanted to make sure that not only the lobbyists and the most effective advocates got their way on fuels and moving towards incentives and taxes and mandates, but so that the public at least was aware, so that you could start a dialogue to talk about fuels choices, technologies, and options that are available to us, especially as we go forward. Okay. This entire session is on the record. We'll have the presentations, with the permission of our panelists, posted on our website either this afternoon or tomorrow. And with that, let me turn the program over to Doug Arendt here, and we'll start the day's activities. Thank you.
Thanks, Frank. Good morning, everyone. So as Frank mentioned, this is the second in a series that we're hosting over the next number of months. The first one, if you'll have the opportunity to go to the CSIS website, covered broadly alternative fuels and options. And this one, as Frank mentioned, is focused specifically on biofuels. And we wanted to put this one up front, essentially, because biofuels is the subject of much news coverage, much discussion, much debate, and much misinformation and information. And so what we wanted to do was bring together a series of experts to present both academic perspectives as well as corporate perspectives on different aspects of biofuels, be it the positive side, be it some questions. And also to bring, shall I call it a responder, someone who's not going to speak with many prepared remarks, but someone to perhaps listen between the lines. And that's Bruce Everett, who's going to help lead our panel discussion this morning. So we hope the session will offer you a wide variety of perspectives. That's the important point of this dialogue, is to inform the public policy debate. We've intentionally invited, as I say, a broad range of speakers. You're going to hear positive aspects from some analytics. You're going to hear some corporate perspectives, some strategy, and what that means. And it's all to help inform, I think, your questions. I'm going to ask that you hold your questions to the end. We're going to try to reserve a solid block of time for good dialogue, and we'll moderate that at the end of the session. We'll have a short break, if we can keep your attention, about halfway through. So the next sessions, as Frank mentioned, will be at the end of the month with MIT, but more importantly, following that, we're going to hold a couple of carbon to liquids sessions. So carbon broadly, that might be coal, shale, alternatives, et cetera. And so look for those remarks. And I'm not going to read the bios. I think you have them in your packets. And so with that, we're going to turn, we're going to go through each panelist for 15 to 20 minutes of formal remarks. Again, please hold your questions, and we'll go from there. So I'd like to introduce today's first speaker, John Sheehan. John is with the National Renewable Energy Laboratory and has been a biofuels analyst for many, many years, and a pleasure to welcome him. So, John. And I think
you're right there. Oh, thank you for doing that. I'm a Mac user. These PCs scare me a little bit. It's actually kind of fun for me to be in the position of kind of giving the first of the overview talks, if you will, to try and deliberately frame the discussion, if I can, at as broad and as high a level as possible. And so with that, let me jump in. Here's the perspective that motivates me in my 15 years of doing biomass work, And now the strategic analysis work that I do with Doug Arendt and the Strategic Energy Analysis Center at NREL. Fundamentally, the challenge, and wherever you see the word challenge, you can sort of add in there also possibly the opportunity for biomass, relates to sustainable energy supplies and to sustainable development more broadly. And there is a the well-known biologist E.O. Wilson, who I think captured the essence of what sustainable development is all about very well. And in much of the studies that I have done as an analyst, I have literally used his definition here to focus the work that I do. So I am with, if you'll pardon me, I'm actually just going to read this to you. The common aim must be to expand resources and improve quality of life for as many people as heedless population growth forces upon Earth, and do it with minimal prosthetic dependence. That, in essence, is the ethic of sustainable development. There are a bunch of key words in there that I've highlighted. You can very much see there's a Malthusian thread here that runs through Wilson's thinking in terms of what the planet can handle in terms of population. But he grabs the key issues. Expanding resources. I might call that extending or leveraging natural resources. Improving quality of life. There are an infinite number of political, economic, and ethical issues tied up in that one aspect of sustainability. The questions of the Earth and how much it can handle. This question of minimal prosthetic dependence, which I'll skip for now because that's a confusing term that he's used there, but I think one that I'll address later. And again, it is an ethical issue. And this thing that surprisingly enough looks like a bullseye is Wilson's representation of the fact that these kinds of issues, like sustainable development, bring together the science, the economics, the politics, and the ethics all in one place where it has to be dealt with. And these are the toughest issues to come to terms with. So let me walk through very briefly a couple of those key points as they relate to biofuels and biomass. First, expanding resources. The fundamental issue for biomass is there enough land out there to do this? Now, I'm not going to walk you through the details of this slide, except to say that it's what I'm showing here is an interesting sort of thought experiment about, you know, sort of asking at a very high level, is there enough land out there to do what we want to do? This is work that I did with a friend and colleague of mine, Lee Lind at Dartmouth College, in conjunction with the Natural Resources Defense Council. And basically, if you start at the top and you say to yourself, what if I take the technology that exists today and try to apply it to meeting all of our demand for light and heavy-duty fuels? What you're going to come up with in our calculations is well over 1 billion acres of land that would be required. Now, in the United States, which has a lot of good prime agricultural land, that total is only 400 million. And that represents the side of the argument that says this is a silly notion because there just isn't enough land out there. But if you begin to look and be a little more forward-thinking about what the technology might be able to do down the road, what we might be able to do to introduce energy crops with greater productivities and efficiencies in farming, what we might be able to do to improve the yield and performance of conversion technologies. And then last, but definitely not least, what if we actually improve vehicle efficiency in this country? And when you pull all those levers, you start to get down to numbers that are high, you know, on the order of 60 million acres of land that might meet current demand. But on the other hand, it's not a billion acres. So what we need to struggle with is remind ourselves to look down the road at where we can get and not just stay too focused on where we are. But keep in mind that biomass may be renewable, but it is not limitless. And that actually, in my opinion, is its virtue. The fact of the matter is it's limited by land. It's limited by our ability to produce biomass on land. And in some ways, that could be a good thing, because I think if we were more reliable on a renewable energy system, it would actually force some constraints on our demands for energy. I won't spend any time here other than to say In addition to the typical area of biomass that you hear about, there is also technology that I worked on a number of years ago that looked at microalgae as a source of producing liquid fuels. These algae grow in desert lands with saline water conditions that are not appropriate for agriculture, so it doesn't compete for agricultural land, and its resource-based potential is much, much larger than today's soybean resource that is currently used for biodiesel. Now, other resource issues, water. Water is an issue which I think has little been discussed when it comes to biomass, and it is a desperately needed set of studies and dialogue that we need to have, because there is substantial water use that is involved in the production of biofuels, whether you're talking about corn ethanol, cellulosic ethanol, or biodiesel. Quality of life issues. I tackle that in a couple of ways. One is the obvious one we're feeling today, and that's the security issue of our petroleum supply, which is showing an ever-increasing amount of imported oil requirements that we have to maintain our oil appetite or our addiction, as President Bush put it. The other is cost. We've seen a sea change in oil prices. And that's reflected by the fact that the official arm of energy projections for the Department of Energy, the Energy Information Administration, really suddenly their future projections for oil took a step change. They jumped. And if you look at their high oil cases, they're looking at oil prices that are conceivably approaching $100 a barrel of oil over the next 20 to 30 years. So how does biomass fit into that cost issue and that security issue? Here is just one example of technology. I don't want to spend the time to describe the technology itself, but it is clearly a cornerstone of the biomass program at the Department of Energy, focusing on the biological conversion of the cellulose and the sugars in biomass into ethanol. And the advances that they're making lead to projected cost improvements from a cost that we estimated might have been around $5 a gallon of gasoline equivalent in the year 2000 down to less than a dollar a gallon by 2030 if the sort of ultimate nirvana of technology, really a consolidated bioprocess, can be achieved for the technology. Now, you can compare that on this chart. The yellow lines reflect the projected gasoline prices from EIA for both low reference and high oil. And I wouldn't necessarily suggest that means biomass is going to deliver fuel at less than a dollar a gallon. But what it is going to do is find its way into the marketplace with the amount of room for profit that these charts imply. Now, minimal prosthetic dependence in the sustainability equation. I translate that as a person who likes to think in terms of systems as the broad life cycle implications of whatever it is we choose to do. And in this case, it's a life cycle system that looks at using the sun to capture carbon from the atmosphere and photosynthetically process it into biomass that we can then process into fuel and use in our cars. I say minimal prosthetic dependence because this is a system that is as closely tied to natural cycles of photosynthetic movement of carbon as you can get. Where is the prosthetic dependence in here? Well, you'll notice that there are some fossil energy inputs that exist along the line in here. And much of the debate about whether or not biomass is sustainable revolves around this question of how big is that fossil energy input and how much is fossil energy subsidizing our ability to make biofuels. And we'll hear from Tad Patzik on that. He and I have very different views. I'm glad we're both here because this is a dialogue that absolutely needs to happen. The analyses that I've done and some of my colleagues have done show that fossil energy use, even for corn ethanol, is actually less than the consumption of fossil energy associated with driving on gasoline. I did a study in 1998 looking at biodiesel, and it shows a fourfold improvement or reduction in energy, fossil energy consumption in our analysis over its comparable petroleum-based diesel fuel. perhaps more importantly right now, and again in the corn ethanol debate you get into this in a big way, is not just the question of are we reducing fossil fuels, but what are we doing to eliminate our dependence on petroleum. And there, we, in our analyses, we see that corn, biodiesel, and cellulosic ethanol all have very substantial impacts on reducing petroleum use. And that's because the corn ethanol process, although it may use a lot of fossil energy, does not rely heavily on oil. Let's talk a little bit about the Earth issues. That fossil energy balance equates directly to greenhouse gas reductions that you can achieve with things like corn stover, woods, and grasses as energy crops. And clearly, the carbon balance or savings associated with corn grain is much, much lower because there is a lot of fossil energy inputs that go into that system. And I'm a firm believer, having done enough of these life cycle studies, that if anybody gets up here and says, there are no problems, we've got the sustainable answer, hold on to your wallet. I don't believe people who want to sell you the perfect story. And there are going to be issues. And here is an example of one that has to be dealt with in agriculture, and that's the problem of very, very high nitrogen emissions associated with the farming sector that have to be addressed in order to bring down this impact or load of nitrogen in the atmosphere coming from things like corn production. Then there's the effect that nitrogen in farming is having on the on our water quality. The famous hypoxia that occurs at the base of the Mississippi water basin every year is a direct result of nitrogen that is used as fertilizer in the Midwest and in much of our farming area. Now, I like to emphasize the fact that this is an ethical issue that we're facing here. And ethical issues are tough. It gets really tough when both science and politics and ethics are all going to be commingled. And as a result of that, we have a very, very strong mandate as technologists, in my case, or as an analyst, to make the issues of uncertainty in the technologies that we're looking at as clear as possible. Now, here is a case where if we compare a publication from Tad Patzick and his colleague David Pimentel at Cornell, where the differences in analysis that we have done looking at the fossil energy balance for cellulosic ethanol is very different, dramatically different, unacceptably different from what has been presented in the Pimentel work. This is a degree of contrast that the public is never and shouldn't have to deal with, and it has to be corrected. I actually recently participated in a two-hour radio discussion with David Pimentel on these issues. And finally, I mean, if you could believe that someone would have a two-hour show on just energy and on biomass, we actually had a chance to really talk. And I think started opening the doors for where there is common ground in the questions of analysis and in the questions of ethics that David Pimentel has about biomass. And in fact, Tad and I participated in a National Press Club debate a year ago, 2 years ago. Time flies. That's working for Doug Arendt. And this was an attempt to put the two sides up for public viewing, if you will. I represented, if you will, the argument that corn ethanol and cellulosics have positive energy balances, and David Pimentel and Tad Patzick presented the case that they're negative. Unfortunately, given sort of the almost showtime nature of a one-hour, okay, you get to talk and now you get to talk, we didn't really have discussion. And I don't think that we really cleared any issues there. I personally have spent 12 years in education as a member of a board of education for a very large school district in Colorado. And my mentor in education and philosophy is Dr. Mortimer Adler, who at the beginning of one of his books on education says, "Let us engage in the serious business of conducting our discussion rationally and logically to discover the truth about points on which we differ." Having experts throw barbs at each other in the public or in the peer-reviewed literature is not having rational and logical discussion. Finally, I'll just end with this one picture of a possible sustainable future that was developed in conjunction with our work that we did with the Natural Resources Defense Council. And in fact, I was at a conference in Iowa where this particular cute term here that I have on my slide came up. There is no silver bullet for our sustainable energy future. There's only silver buckshot. It's going to be quite a wide mix of things that are going to have to be used to meet the solution. And what's shown here is a scenario for eliminating petroleum dependence over the next 50 years through a combination of vehicle efficiency, smart growth, a term that might frighten some people, and the introduction of biofuels. And you'll notice that the largest impact on reducing our consumption of oil for gasoline is coming from the vehicle efficiency, the demand side management for energy, not from the fuel side. And if we can get anything across in all of this discussion, it's to recognize that the technologies that we work on at NREL, that people are promoting as alternatives to our current fossil energy system, are not in and of themselves going to sustain our current levels of demand and consumption. And with that, I'll stop.
Thank you, John. Let's see. With that set of opening remarks, we're going to turn to John Reese now from Shell. And if I can work the projector here. Hopefully this will provide some good contrast for you. John, all yours.
Hi. Thank you very much. It's very nice to have been invited here to share Shell's insights and perspective on renewable fuels, and it's nice to be back in Washington, D.C., and see a lot of familiar faces here as well. I spent most of my life here in the D.C. area and just moved to Houston about 4 years ago, so I always enjoy coming back and seeing old friends. First, I'd like to provide you a little background on Shell and our fuels. First, as many of you know, Shell has over 100 years of experience developing the technology and services that make us the leading provider of innovative and new fuels. Shell also has probably the broadest fuels technology portfolio of any major oil company. And in addition to this distinctive capability, we have the commitment to help meet the transportation needs of our customers and of society now and in the future. And I stress in the future because, as you will see later on in this presentation, Shell is investing hundreds of millions of dollars in new technology for renewable fuels and energy sources. And the reason we are doing this is because we want to be the leading provider for the next generation of fuel solutions. I'd like to take a minute to provide some context around the challenges that come with the aspiration to be the fuels technology innovator. And to do that, it's helpful to provide some depth and breadth of Shell's global reach as a fuels retailer, and hence the magnitude of the challenge that we face. Our downstream business has 84,000 people, 50 refineries, and operates six different classes of business around the world. We produce, market, and sell fuels and chemicals to over 25 million customers a day in over 100 different countries. We supply 10% of the world's total ground transport fuels. We operate the largest single-branded retail network on the planet with over 46,000 service stations. And finally, we are probably the largest marketer of biofuels in the world. Looking forward, Shell and the industry as a whole face three key global energy challenges. The first is providing accessible modern energy for all of us well into the future. The second, meeting growing energy demand while reducing social and environmental impacts. And thirdly, finding ways to shift towards a low-carbon energy. Through our scenarios work at Shell, we continue to look at how these challenges may manifest themselves in different scenarios. And this is a view of what the future of road transport fuel demand could look like. It's not a prediction, really, but it's a possibility, taking into all the different factors that we face. And the key message here is that liquid hydrocarbon fuels continue to be central to the fuels mix. However, new fuel components will become increasingly important over the years. Over the course of the next 15 years, new fuel technologies, principally biofuels and synthetic fuels will become increasingly available, and Shell continues to invest in our fuels technology portfolio to meet that fuels energy demand. As many of you know, we have significant investments in biofuels research and development and biofuel technologies, as evidenced by our partnerships with Iogen, which is a leader in converting biomass to cellulosic ethanol, and Corin, which is a leader in converting biomass to liquid fuels. Now, looking forward, the $64,000 question is, what is the perfect fuel? And as you can probably imagine, with 25 million customers a day, and with all the many stakeholders and their interests, there are many pressures on us and others in the fuels industry to develop and deliver the perfect fuel. Well, this chart, as you can see, depicts the main features demanded by all these various stakeholders. And the various stakeholders want different qualities from a fuel, including infrastructure compatibility, high mileage, high performance. It's got to be widely available, some interest in locally sourced, renewable, zero or negative CO2 emissions, zero local emissions, and it has to be, in the end, affordable as well. But the reality is that there's no simple answer. There's no cookie-cutter solution to this. While one fuel may address some needs, it probably won't meet others. And speaking of renewable fuels, the question is, how do ethanol and other renewable fuels fit into this picture? Ethanol from corn has a number of benefits. It's renewable. It's a good source of octane, which is important for us to make high-performance fuels. And it's recognized in EPA's proposed rule that they issued last week that it reduces some emissions, CO and CO2 emissions. On the other hand, ethanol has some challenges. Ethanol is very hydrophilic, which means it's water-loving. It is attracted to water. And that means it cannot be transported in multi-product pipelines like petroleum products. Rather, ethanol has to be shipped separately from where it's produced by rail, truck, and barge to the terminals. Terminals have to be upgraded to be able to mix the ethanol with the hydrocarbon right as the fuel in the mixture goes into a tanker truck on its way to retail. And that adds complexity to the system. It adds cost, and it is a challenge. While ethanol decreases some emissions, it increases others, including VOC and NOx emissions, which EPA recognized in a proposal that they issued last week. And VOC and NOx emissions are related to ground-level ozone, or smog, as we know. And first-generation ethanol from corn or sugar competes with the food chain. E85, there's been a lot of discussion about E85 in the press as late and a lot of interest, but E85 has some additional challenges above those of ethanol in general. E85 is not compatible with standard retail dispensers or nozzles, so retail stations would have to be upgraded to be compatible with E85. In contrast to 10% ethanol blends, E85 is not compatible with most cars that are on the road today. And finally, the mileage of cars is reduced by approximately 25% to 30% when using E85 relative to hydrocarbon gasoline. Second generation ethanol has several benefits versus first generation. There are greater CO2 emission reduction benefits of second generation ethanol. The feedstocks to produce second generation ethanol do not compete with food uses, and there's a potential for reduced cost with second generation. It's important to recognize that there may be even other renewable fuels beyond first-generation ethanol or biodiesel that have additional benefits and fewer challenges. We believe that regulatory programs should make room for these possibilities. And that's the approach that EPA took in the proposed rule that they issued last week to implement the renewable fuel standard that Congress passed last year. And that proposed rule allows for the broad participation of renewable fuels and even anticipates that there may be future renewable fuels that are not even yet contemplated that should be allowed to participate in the program. So the proposed rule makes room for all of those, whether it's first-generation ethanol, second-generation ethanol, biodiesel, second-generation biodiesel, renewable fuels, biomass to liquid fuels, butanol, biogas, et cetera, et cetera. And in addition, they establish in the credit trading program, equivalence values for the various different renewable fuels because there has to be some way to account for them in the system. And EPA pr- it takes the approach of providing credits based on the energy content of the various different renewable fuels. We're still reviewing EPA's proposal. It's 239 pages. It was issued late last week, so I haven't gotten through it all yet myself, but I'm working on it. But the direction that EPA has taken to allow the broad participation of all renewable fuels is, I believe, directionally correct. As EPA recognizes there are several possibilities beyond first-generation ethanol, and there even could be new fuels that we haven't even developed yet that may have additional benefits with less challenges for us to deliver, ultimately, fuels to consumers. So in sum, the solution to all of this is as complex as this picture. Consumers demand performance and mileage from their fuels, and they want it to be affordable. Some interest groups and regulators focus on local emissions and carbon dioxide emissions. Governments are also focused on energy security and locally sourced fuels. There's no simple answer to fuels in general or biofuels in particular. It's a difficult challenge to manage as we search for this perfect fuel. So how is Shell tackling some of these challenges? Well, one example is the progression of biofuels and biofuels technology. We are a leader in the development of second-generation biofuels technology. And when I refer to second-generation biofuels, I mean biofuels that can not only be delivered to consumers more cost-effectively, but they're significantly better in wells-to-wheels CO2 emission reductions, and more importantly, they do not compete with the food chain. Two things that we're very actively working on is, on the left here, is the conversion of cellulosic biomass to ethanol. Instead of taking the corn that competes with the food chain, the kernels, and converting it to ethanol, we're working on converting the stalks to ethanol with Iogen. And then as far as biodiesel fuels are concerned, instead of using the parts of the plant that compete with the food chain, we're working on converting the stalks there to distillate fuels through a process that basically gasifies the otherwise waste material and then uses a synthesis process to put the gas together to make a liquid distillate fuel, which is essentially a diesel fuel. Overall, Shell's approach to fuels is that we provide quality, cost, and competitive conventional fuels. We're a global leader in differentiated fuels. We're an early leader in GTL, that's gas to liquids. It's really that process I was just talking about with the biomass to liquids. There's a process right now to convert gas to liquids. You just synthesize the gas molecules to make this distillate fuel. Well, you can use the biomass to produce the gas to produce that fuel. We have partnerships with automobile manufacturers and technology companies. We're selling first-generation biofuels today. We're probably the world's largest distributor of fuels containing biofuels. We're proactively working on advanced biofuels with Iogen, with cellulosic ethanol, and Corin with the biomass to liquid. And we're preparing for longer-term fuels like hydrogen. Just in summary and to conclude, let me just summarize by saying that our work with advanced biofuels is part of our ongoing effort to invest in technologies and partnerships that will make us the leading provider of the next generation of fuel solutions as we strive to deliver quality, cost-competitive, and environmentally friendly fuels. Thank you.
Well, there's one perspective from the oil and gas industry, and we're going to now turn to Bill Fry and hear a perspective from the other side of the equation. And let's see if I can get this up and running. It's in a different program, but I think I can get it to work. Yeah. Now, do you want me to?
That's good. No. We can't walk around. I assume you're recording it. Right?
Yes.
And this is down.
Down and up, right? I think that should.
Yeah, got it.
Perfect.
Okay.
Great.
Thank you. Good morning. Thanks to Doug, NREL, CSIS for inviting us to be here today.
I don't think I've ever been introduced, however, as the oil and gas industry.
No, no,
so.
I'm sorry.
So I found that we'll try to do the best we can. I'm going to speak, actually, a little bit as it relates to that, because if you speak about biofuels, you have to speak about oil and gas. You have to speak about energy, so we'll do that. I'm going to assume a certain level of understanding on the part of the audience, and I'm not here to talk about the past. I'm here to give you a couple of concrete examples of what the future might be. So as we talk about alternative fuels, I think a lot of people know where we are today. I'll comment on that a little bit. But I'm really here to give you a couple of concrete examples of how we're looking at what the future could hold and how we, DuPont, are trying to participate in that. This is a, you know, as I'm speaking to you publicly, we wanted to just put this up here as forward-looking statements. You may or may not know that a few years ago we formed something we called DuPont Bio-Based Materials. It was a business unit that was designed to help us to look at the possibility of growing the DuPont company by moving away from the dependence on petroleum and moving toward a dependence on agricultural feedstocks. So we actually put an entire effort in place to look at how we might do that. This whole area is called industrial biotech or white biotechnology. I'm assuming everyone's heard those phrases before. That's what our strategy was about, to see where those opportunities might exist and how we could participate in those. Biofuels expansion is one of those possibilities. So as we've looked at this, it's how can we use agricultural feedstocks all the way through to the market, and that has taken the form in our minds as both feedstocks to chemicals and feedstocks to fuels. So today I'm only going to I'll comment just briefly about the chemical part of it, but primarily comment about the biofuels. Interesting in the space of energy, and I don't know how many times people get to see this, so I thought I'd bring this. This is my oil and gas slide. So this is the one that says, if you look at the world of primary energy supplies, you notice how in all areas except transportation, there have been there are a lot of options that you have. And you can ask yourself, why is that? And I would, not having done a study myself, but I could suggest that the economics of alternatives is probably the major reason for that. So as you look at stationary, you see a whole lot of hydroelectric power and coal and gas and oil, liquid transportation. In the liquid transportation area, there has been a lack of economic alternatives. And that's what's been the driver behind all of the efforts that people have made to look at alternative fuels. And it's also a reason why, if you go into how did we get to where we are today in biofuels, you'll find a very strong policy component to that. Because in the case of these other alternatives, the economics can win out. In the case of where we are in liquid transportation fuel, you could make an argument that policy is an extremely important element for biofuels to become a part of that that mix of fuels. So although this is a somewhat stagnant picture, this isn't today's exact picture, we would anticipate that over time, the left portion of this slide, the liquid transportation portion, will have more alternatives. And so I'm here to talk about a couple of what those alternatives might be. Everyone's aware that biofuels are large and they're growing fast. You get very disparate numbers from people as to how big they are, how big they could be. It's fairly clear where we are. So in the U.S. today, everyone knows it's ethanol and biodiesel. Ethanol, I think our capacity in the U.S. today is somewhere about 4.7 billion gallons. We're probably producing a little less than that, but the capacity is about up to 4.7 billion. Biodiesel is a seriously smaller amount, primarily due to the fact that biodiesel economics are more challenged than ethanol economics are. So you see it's large, it's growing. There should have been, it's not projecting. There's a picture of the world behind this that is not projecting, but the reason we have the boxes is to show that this is not a U.S. or North America-only phenomenon. Brazil has been very effective over the past 25 years, growing to have a serious 25% of their liquid transportation fuels coming from ethanol. And in fact, I think they just claimed victory in becoming independent of imported oil. So the combination of ethanol and other sources of energy in Brazil, they've claimed victory. The U.S. is in a very strong position, driven by a whole bunch of different drivers. You know, the renewable supply issue, rural development is an extremely interesting aspect of alternative biofuels. For the first time, because of the nature of the feedstock, you have to do distributed manufacturing. The whole history of industry has always been bigger is better is better is better. This is completely different. scenario. The scenario is one, the feedstocks are distributed, the manufacturing will be distributed, and you end up with the huge opportunity for rural development in a way that an industry, I don't know of an industry that's had that opportunity for many, many, many years. So that's part of the driver. Drivers around energy security has become perhaps the biggest push over the past year. But all of these are elements of why people are interested. Europe is interested because of greenhouse gas and the Kyoto Protocol, as well as energy security. So these drivers are different. They vary by region, but they're important. This talk was science and biofuels opportunities. So everybody knows there's a big opportunity. What is it that we might be able to do about that? So I don't want to do a technical here. This is, I think, my only technical slide. On what basis do we feel DuPont can bring science to help to expand this opportunity? We've done a lot of work in terms of looking at microbes as cell factories. So this depiction on the right of a cell factory, this is just a bacteria, could be a yeast. But rather than having, so traditionally in the chemical industry, petroleum industry, the factory is a large footprint, building, steel, concrete. What we're looking at in this case is how can we use microbes as the cell factory to take agricultural feedstocks and turn them into chemicals and biofuels. We've been very successful at our first attempt at this. We're about to start up a plant in Loudoun, Tennessee, that will make a molecule that will go into a carpet, and next year you'll be able to go to Home Depot and buy a carpet that a major component of which came from corn, first time. So we're very excited about that. In order to do that, we had to develop this technology. So we said to ourselves, now that we know how to do this, we know how to make a cell factory, we know how to make it extremely productive, what could we do in the biofuel space? I think many of you probably know that we made an announcement in June about a partnership we've formed with BP to look at biofuels, and in this case to look at advanced biofuels. So most industries never end up with only one or two solutions. At the moment, our solution for gasoline is ethanol. We believe that biobutanol is another solution for biofuels in liquid transportation. It has characteristics that make it very interesting as a blending agent in fuels. It's not a competitor for ethanol. We believe that by taking this approach, we're going to expand the possibilities for biofuels, not compete for biofuels. Here are some of the performance issues. And John mentioned some of the issues associated with using ethanol today. It goes across. For these to be successful, for any advanced biofuel to be successful, it has to meet real needs. Butanol does that within the supply chain, the infrastructure of providing fuels, all the way from it has to be a cost competitive, so this isn't an issue of one fuel being able to come into the marketplace and not be cost competitive with alternatives. It has to have that. It has to have blend flexibility. Butanol, as it turns out, provides a huge amount of infrastructure flexibility in terms of blending at refineries and being able to ship through pipelines, as opposed to the situation that John described where ethanol has to be shipped to the location prior to going to the retail outlet and blended there. So there's infrastructure benefits. Butanol is more dense, so it improves miles per gallon versus ethanol. Vehicle modifications are the numbers and type of modifications are reduced by using butanol. Butanol, we believe, is an alternative choice. It is not a competitive choice, but certainly in different places of the world, in the U.S., butanol, in fact, improves the performance of an ethanol blend. So the U.S. could end up having butanol-ethanol blends in gasoline. They could have them as separate. Point simply being, the opportunity of biofuels is big. There's an opportunity for advanced biofuels beyond those that we know today. We are very supportive of that. We're participating here to provide one of those options. John mentioned that there's likely to be others. We believe there will be others. So we're at the very beginning of this industry. And every industry, when you first start, thinks it knows all that it needs to know, and of course it doesn't, and there are other things that are possible. We just wanted to use this as an example of one of those possible things. There's one other element of this where we are participating. So here's the butanol advanced biofuel opportunity. Everyone is aware of the issue of cellulose. Ultimately, again, the issue of the economics of doing these biofuels is critical for their success. This is perhaps one of the most challenging of them all, the cellulose conversion technology and making those economics correct. So we have an effort with the Department of Energy to look at doing this, converting cellulose into biofuels or chemicals. This is all about making the opportunity for biofuels much larger than they are today, getting at some of the issues that that were mentioned earlier around feedstock supply, economics. And I point out, of course, on the bottom that, and I don't know that everyone knows this, but John, I think you mentioned that currently available agricultural feedstocks can't meet all the needs for liquid transportation. Cellulose, added to current options, doesn't in fact allow you to eliminate oil, but it certainly increases dramatically the amount of biofuel options that you have available to you. So what are we doing? We're all about right science, process, and products. I gave you two examples. I didn't talk about the first of what we're doing today. We are already in the market of biofuels around our seed and crop protection products. We're looking at advanced fuels. Biobutanol is one of those examples. We expect that there will be others. We think biobutanol is an excellent first step at expanding the opportunities. And then cellulosic feedstocks will come along, must come along. Like I said, we are participating in terms of trying to apply our chemistry and engineering and now adding the biology to that to try to make that successful. I just wanted to give you those two examples. I hope that was helpful. Look forward to your questions later. Thank you.
Thank you. I guess I'll take the time to apologize for the misinterpretation of we had heard from an oil and gas and we were going to convert back to now from a science company, really. I think we'll take an opportunity to take a short 5-minute break, and we'll come back and finish the panel and then welcome questions and a dialogue. Thank you. We're going to turn now to our final prepared remarks, although Bruce will put some framing remarks together for us to open the panel discussion. So let me welcome Professor Tad Patzik to the podium, and hopefully we'll hear some informed alternative opinions here. So please welcome Tad.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm surely glad to be here, and I'll get on with my presentation, and will actually try to teach you a few things. I will actually follow up on John Sheehan's presentation, and you will see that we differ in emphasis, but really sort of the strategic thinking doesn't differ much at all. I will run out of time, so I'm going to give my important points first. So I guess I would like to stress that the astronomic scale, and I'll tell you what it is, of energy consumption from fossil plants and the minute scale of energy production from new plants are fundamentally incompatible. Fundamentally incompatible. In engineered crop systems, that's everything that was mentioned today, we continuously apply fossil fuels and nutrients to replenish soil. All biofuel systems are, in fact, very inefficient ways of producing energy. And it seems to me, and I will give you some numbers, that photovoltaic cells seem to be the most energy-efficient alternative to crude oil, but only if these cells can be mass-produced and equipped with better electricity storage system, which, by the way, really don't exist right now. I will use some units here for a change, and the fundamental unit I will use is 1 exajoule. 1 exajoule is 1 with 18 zeros, 10 to the 18th joule. It's an astronomic amount of energy. In fact, it's the amount of energy that will feed, when ingested, will feed 300 million Americans for 1 year. So that's my fundamental unit of energy, the amount of food that we need to live and then get a little bit fatter while we at it. A single person uses about 100 joules per second, and that's about 100 watts. So each one of us is just like one this 100-watt bulb working continuously. And these are the two scales I'm going to refer to. Currently, we are using here in the U.S. about 105 times more than we need to live. And if you did a thought experiment and tried to imagine what would happen if you ingested this amount of energy, each one of us would be a 40-ton, 15 meters or more high, big, fat sperm whale. So look around and imagine yourself being a sperm whale going through the earth and trampling it with every step we make. So now I can start my talk. So, of course, there are these claims of plentiful biomass for biofuels, and what I'm going to just tell you is a little bit about the Greenland area in the U.S., solar energy sequestration as biomass from agriculture, pastures, forests, and lumber plantations. Then I'm going to go very briefly through energy efficiencies of a few large-scale biomass systems, and I'm going to do U.S. corn, grain, and stover, Brazilian sugarcane, and Indonesian acacias, because they are the fastest-growing trees there are. So this is the best it gets. And then I'll try to pick a winning technology and have some conclusions. Of course, Doug will cut me off before that. There are these claims of plentiful biofuel, biomass, and then biofuels from it. And there is a DOE report which basically says that there is 1.3 billion dry tons of biomass that are readily available with modest changes in land and agricultural use and forestry practices. And then other people go and pick up on this and say, aha, so we have 130 billion gallons of something unnamed, but I take it it's ethanol, per year. And then, of course, DOE Secretary Bodman has a more modest goal and at the same time frame says, well, let's replace 30% of transportation fuels. So let's look at that. So I'm going to do the numbers, okay? So 130 billion gallons of ethanol, it's basically 11.4 exajoules, so 11 times more than we need as the population to eat. 1.3 billion tons of dry biomass is about 22 exajoules per year, year after year for decades. You need that, you know, steady supply to have your fuels to be able to drive. That brings us to the overall conversion efficiency, if you divide one through the other, of about 52%. That's an enormously high conversion efficiency. In fact, it's over two times higher than the average energy efficiency of the current corn ethanol cycle, which is pretty much optimized as far as it goes. Now, the current crop production is from best agricultural land in the U.S. You have to remember this. So as we expand production to other land, it can only go down, not up. There is not enough clean water, and this was mentioned by John. That's actually a very, very relevant point. And, of course, I will venture to say that industrial cellulosic ethanol technology really does not exist, and therefore and biomass gasification is in early stages of development. So let's look at the U.S. consumption. You have seen various versions of this graph, but this is sort of billions of gallons. That's something that you readily will understand. And so we use about 314 billions of gallons of crude oil, 284 billions of gallons of finished petroleum products, 140 billion gallons of gasoline, 63 billion gallons of distillate oil. That's basically your that's your diesel fuel. About 25 billion gallons of jet fuel. There's a little bit of bunker fuel for ships, and about 2 billion gallons of ethanol equivalent, because I had to adjust the energy. So that's a 1% solution, okay? So we're talking now, for the time being, 1% solution, maybe later on 2 or 3% solution. Now, let's look at the same graph historically and in my favorite unit. So this is exajoules, 40 times as much as we need to live. And this is the last 50 years of gasoline growth, up to almost 20 exajoules. On top of it, you have diesel fuel, and on top of it, you have jet fuel, up to about 33 exajoules. The curve at the bottom here is the current ethanol production. I don't know if you can see it, but if so, put your glasses on. And for comparison, I'm giving you the sum of oil and gas production from the two largest and most productive fields on the earth, and that's Ghawar and Burgan in Saudi Arabia. And they are insufficient to satisfy the energy needs of the United States. This is the 130 billion gallon goal set by ambitious people, and this is the Alaska crude oil output, just to give you sort of a sense of perspective on the quantities involved here. So here's the total area of Greenland in the U.S., and it's measured in hectares, so multiplied by 2.5, you're going to get acres. So cropland is around 130 million hectares. Then you have a little bit of pastures, idle and failed crops. Then pasture land and rangeland is about 160 million hectares. There are interdispersed trees here, and that's called woodland, a little bit, 25 or 30 million hectares. There is about 300 million hectares of forest and timber. That's 765 million acres. And so cropland and rangeland altogether are 830 million acres, if you want to lump them together, and I'm taking into account U.S., Alaska, Hawaii, you name it. If you look at the crop areas, and they, again, they are in millions of acres, this is soybean, this is corn, and they are about 30 million hectares, so that's an area of Arizona, okay, more or less, or all my old country, Poland. Then there's hay, wheat, cotton, and there's a whole bunch of smaller crops. And these crops add to about 300 million acres, so that's a majority of cropland which is actively used in the U.S. Now, in order to convert this into energy, you need to have a few numbers, and these numbers are highly uncertain. And a lot of a game starts here, how people play with these numbers. The first one is the so-called harvest index, so you need to know how many kilograms of harvested seeds, corn, grain, per kilogram of biomass above ground you have. And that's a variable number, you can estimate it. Then you need to know how many, what's the mass of roots at harvest divided by the mass above the ground at harvest. Then, of course, you need, that's a highly uncertain number, you need moisture contents of crops of above ground biomass and roots, highly uncertain. And then, of course, you need high heating values of these various plants, plant parts. But you can make assumptions and convert all of this into energy. So let's do that. And here is, again, my favorite unit, exajoules. That's 5 exajoules. So that's amount of energy sufficient to feed the population of China. Okay. So corn, of course, dominates U.S. agriculture. And in fact, the energy in corn grain is more than Brazil ever used as crude oil. So Brazil, the total consumption of crude oil of Brazil is in fact less than the energy in corn grain in the United States. And I'll be happy to answer your further questions later on. Then a third of it is soybeans. In fact, all other crops are less than corn in terms of energy that they produce. If you look at the remainder, so the plant stem energy other than the grain, again, that's probably way too optimistic because I took very dry plants. And that's about 6 exajoules. So 9 plus 6, that's 15. Okay, and there's another 3 exajoules in roots. Okay, that's a fairly good estimate. So if you then divide all of this energy by the area and the number of seconds per year, that's the continuous power you can draw from all these crops. Okay, and in fact, 1 square meter of land surface, on average, this is sort of mass-weighted average, can draw 0.4 watts per square meter. So that's a good number, 0.4 watts per square meter of land surface. That's what we can draw as biomass from it. And by the way, you and I draw 11,250 watts continuously of primary energy from our own sources, and I think we import at least 800 watts from the environments of the world. So that's the fundamental incompatibility between what we do and what biomass supplies. Now let's just compare it on one sort of graph. So here's our favorite 105 exajoules, and they consist mostly of crude oil, then coal, then natural gas, then nuclear. This little sliver is biomass, mostly burning biomass for cogeneration, and the other little sliver is hydro. By the way, our enormously wasteful food system uses 22 exajoules per year, and that's way too much. Now let's think about how much energy all plants over the entire area of the United States sequestered per year. And again, that is a quite an optimistic estimate. I was going out of my way to increasing. So this is 88 exajoules, so it's less than what we consume. And then this slither is your basic 15 exajoules for crops and above-ground biomass. Then you have pasture land and range land. Forest and timber, quite substantial. There's lots of forest in the United States. There is these idle crops and whatnot. There's sparse vegetation in Utah and Arizona. And there's a whole lot of energy in roots. We're not going to touch them, hopefully. So if you then look at how much land you would have to use with the DO report efficiency of 52%, we would have to use all biomass on sequestered per year on all croplands, pastureland, and rangeland. If I wanted to go with the current corn ethanol efficiency, I would actually start cutting deeply into our forest and timber supply. Now, we can't do that because much of it is already dedicated to food and feed, well, feed and food in that order, also to lumber, to paper, you know, to many other industrial uses. So we can't do that as well. So I'm going to now switch and tell you how you capture solar energy in these major agricultural systems. And I want you to remember that one human is 100 watts continuously when we move. Right now it's probably 60, and if you fall asleep, it's 50. So I'll explain a little bit better the first plot, and the other ones will be the same. So here is captured or spent power in watts per square meter. The scale is 1 watt, okay? So it's 100 times less than we need to function. And this is what we capture in terms of corn grain and corn stover. It's about 1 watt. Then if we convert the corn grain into ethanol, that's about 0.25 watt per square meter. Then if we were to collect 75% of all stover from the fields, and I call it imaginary, because if you talk to a farmer, they're going to go nuts on you when you say, we're going to just grab all the stover and remove it from the field, because you're going to erode the field and just destroy the whole system. So if we did that and convert it into ethanol, you're going to get about, what, 0.1 watts per square meter. Then if you were to use this in 60% imaginary fuel cell, 60% efficient, and I can tell you why this is imaginary, you're going to actually grab a lot of power and convert this into work. This is your Toyota Prius, about 0.1 watt capability of converting into mechanical work. But it costs us. It costs us about 0.37 watts to grow the corn and then convert it into ethanol. So that means there's additional area of land needed to service our fuel needs. I'm going to translate this into areas. This is Brazilian sugarcane. It got a lot of press. So you can get about 0.4 watts, twice as much almost as from corn in sugarcane ethanol. Now the scale is 2 watts, twice as much. Okay. So there is how much sugar you get, about 0.6 watts. This is your dry bagasse with the attached leaves up to that bar. And then there is leaves you can collect from the field if you don't burn them, and you can burn them in the refinery. As it happens, conversion of sugarcane to ethanol is actually an enormously energy-intensive process. It also costs us about 0.8 watts per square meter to do all of that, to grow the cane, to dry both bagasse and cane, to process them, to make the ethanol and to process the waste. But as it happens, there's a lot of energy in this other biomass, which is being now burned currently by the Brazilians. So this process is energy self-sufficient. And again, if you see how much I capture with ethanol, that's about 0.4 watts. If I do 60% efficient cell, 30% efficient car, I'm going to capture between 0.2 and 0.1 watts. This is acacias, and acacias, again, the units are 2 watts per square meter here. They can capture almost as much as sugarcane in terms of diesel fuel, Fischer Tropsch diesel fuel, and about 0.1 watt per square meter of cellulosic ethanol. Now, they sequester a lot, but we slash a lot and burn it on the plantation. Then we have rather tremendous losses on the way from the plantation to a pellet-making factory. Then we can dry and pelletize the wood, and we can transport it in a tanker from Indonesia or from the tropics to Rotterdam or to New Orleans, and then we can process it in a normal refinery just like anything else. And so that's the plus. And again, we can do electricity, very efficient. And basically, if I want to compare this electricity with the fuel, I have to multiply electricity by 3, because electricity is directly work. Fuel can be converted into work with, let's say, 30% efficiency. So you have to really watch out when people compare electricity and fuels, because the conversion factor is about 3 or more. And again, it costs us a lot of energy to make the pellets and to grow the acacias, and we get this much energy. So what does this mean in terms of capturing solar power? I didn't mean that. What it means is that we have very uneven ways of capturing solar power from the Earth. So this is a mediocre oil field. This Burgan will capture 350 watts per square meter. So if you stand on one square meter of the field, you can actually draw continuously from it about 350 watts, and many American fields are 250 watts. Let's say 100 watts, but for 30 years, you know, or 100 years. That's going to get depleted by no more energy. Okay? Then we have PV cells and wind turbines, and I multiply their efficiency by 3 because they deliver electricity. Therefore, to be primary energy, they look better. And this is the fuel efficiency of all of these biosystems. Can you see it? I can't either. So let's exclude oil. So now solar cells, of course, go to up to, let's say, 25 watts of per square meter of primary energy. A third of it would be electricity. Here's the wind turbines. And again, these are the ranked, all of these biosystems. And I just want to tell you that these solar cells are, in fact, if we just could produce them, which we still cannot really, they are about 400 times more efficient than biofuels. And so let me just give you now an example what it means practically to use this biomass to drive, let's say, a Toyota Prius hybrid 15,000 miles per year at average mileage of 40 miles per gallon. Let's just assume that. And alternatively, I will drive an all-electric car that is 2.5 times more efficient than the Prius, and I will account for the average energy cost of producing gasoline from crude oil, about 17%, and all biofuels from biomass, as in the slides I just showed you. And I will assume rather significant energy costs for manufacturing and deploying PV photovoltaic panels, and that's 33% and 10% and turbines and 10% of their 30-year energy production. So solar cells will be very expensive, but still you will see how they look like. So I just told you that it costs us additional land area to grow biomass from which we take the fuels. So I need to express this. You know, how many square meters of land area do I need for one square meter that will deliver my biofuels? And these are the ratios. And that's three. So that's the scale here is 3.5. PV cells need about additional 3.5, over 3 square meters. Corn grain ethanol needs about 2.78 square meters. And that is the corresponding net energy ratio of 1.44, which is better than what DOE uses. Okay. So this analysis is actually quite optimistic. And then other will require a little bit less area. And, of course, sugarcane requires nothing for a while until we deplete the land and erode the soil. And so this is zero. Okay. And this is the table. I apologize, but otherwise I'm going to confuse you even more. So these are the oil field area to drive a Prius is about 330 square feet for 1 year, 30 square meters. Okay. This is the area that we need just to produce the fuel, and this is the gross ratio, all area that we need to produce the fuel and energy to produce the fuel. Okay, and so you can see that PV cell is about net 4 times less efficient than the oil field, but if we get if we account for the cost of producing PV cells, that's 15 times worse. Wind turbines, in fact, are getting better because the cost of deploying them is less than cost of producing gasoline. Sugarcane ethanol, which is after acacia and producing electricity, the best biofuel system, 250 times less efficient, 214 when you account for the fact that it's self-sustaining. Corn grain ethanol goes to 442 times worse than oil, but if you take into account all the other energy we take, it's about 1,300 times. Corn stover, 1,000 and 1,600 times, and then there are some even less efficient systems. So I want to show it to you on a semi-logarithmic graph, and of course all of you know what that means. That means that any time I go one unit here, it's a factor of 10. Okay? So between here and there is a factor of 10,000. Okay? So here's my oil field. So this is the acres to drive, gross acres to drive a Toyota Prius 15,000 miles or an electrical car. And so here is my oil field. That's 0.008 acres, not a much. The clear winners after that are solar cells and wind turbines, again, with the proviso that we can produce systems that will use them and we can deploy them. then all the most efficient biomass systems happen to be in the tropics. And that's the key here. You have to produce biomass where the sun and the rain are, and that leads us straight into the tropics and destroying the tropical forest. And of course, the losers are all other systems, starting from corn grain ethanol. And so, in conclusion, since I'm running out of time, 30 million hectares, which is the amount of area, which is the size of area with corn in the U.S., will drive you on corn, 7 million producers from grain, plus 6 million producers from stover, for a while until we damage the system. Sugarcane will drive about 44 million producers, also for a while, maybe 10 years. Solar cells, in this comparison, will drive you 646 million electrical cars, and wind turbines, 254 million. So you can see that there is a two-order of magnitude difference between the system, as I just told you. So therefore, my major conclusion is that if you really spend the public money on investing in these alternative systems, spend it on solar cells and electricity. And finally, I want to really stress that there is a lot of confusion in all of this discussion. And there is lots of myths that are being propagated to people that don't know any better. And the first one that I really object to is what I call perpetual mobilomania. And that is, people assume that you can take from the earth forever, put nothing back, and everything's going to be honky-dory. No. Okay. The other one is, I call it hyperyieldemia. And that is, people look at a pot with a plant in a greenhouse, and then they multiply it to millions of hectares with even higher yields and get their numbers. Okay. The other one is, I call it hyperareomania. That is, there are people who say, you know, let's just plow up the whole landscape and put energy crops, and everything's going to be fine. There is the Leibniz syndrome, which basically says, you know what, we are eternal optimists. Everything's going to get better and better ad infinitum. Chrono over leukemia, that's a severe syndrome. It assumes instant technology availability, and it's not so. Okay. And then finally, the most severe syndrome, it's technopsychosis. People see miraculous technologies when none exist. Okay. And with that, I will actually end on a very serious note, that if you look at how much water is pumped through plant leaves, and that's equal biomass, you will see that this is 1,000 millimeters standing on the land, so 1 meter of water across the land. You will see that where water is pumped is where the tropical forests are. And guess what? This is where majority of destruction of tropical forests is occurring right now, courtesy of the same corporations which are bringing you corn, and that is Cargill, ADM, Bunge, who are there in the forefront of destroying the environment. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tad. We're gonna turn to a panel discussion and a couple of reflections as I think about the last few messages. A lot of information. I think as we started, a lot of how should we call it? Contrasting perspectives. I think is the right way to think about it. If I listen between the lines, particularly to the last message. Begs a good question on plug-in electric vehicles and the demand side. I think we're going to hear already a couple of comments and questions about that. And what is in fact the interplay between the transportation fuel or liquid fuels sector, if you want to think about that in marketing lingo, and the electric sector? What does that look like? And maybe we'll bring up some analysts later in the series to talk about that. There's been some interesting work done in there. I think the other point to really think in mind, and we welcome questions relative to the global nature of liquid fuels markets. That's not only petroleum-based fuels markets, but let's think about biofuels markets, both either on the feedstock side and or on the processed side. And I think the last piece is that there are very, very many conflicting both policy goals and societal goals. And that finding a solution that hits all of those is, I would call it, nearly impossible. And so portfolios of solutions which allow one to find balances among all of those competing, necessarily competing goals, but maybe complementary goals, is something that we're going to need to explore. So in order to launch us off with some framing questions and maybe some pieces that we're missing from the comments, I'm going to invite Bruce Everett up, and then we'll go to your questions. Let's see if I can get this going here.
Well, I wasn't quite sure until I heard the presentations what comments to make today, but we've heard some technical observations, and we've heard a number of commercial observations. And what I thought I might do is make some policy observations. It seems to me pretty clear that there are going to be some niche biofuel production opportunities. Lots of entrepreneurs are working on them. We're certainly going to see some of these things. The question for policymakers is whether biofuels are going to be a big enough contributor to actually have some strategic value in terms of our broader goals of reducing oil import dependence, reducing carbon output, and so on. The government doesn't need to take action to create niches. Business people do that by themselves. So the question is, can we bring biofuels into the strategic sphere? Now, Senator Lugar has talked about this quite extensively, and just to sort of put this into perspective, the EIA's forecast is that we'll probably increase our oil consumption from 325 billion gallons a year now to 400 billion gallons by 2025. Senator Lugar has thrown out this number of 100 billion gallons of biofuels. It's an interesting number. It's a good challenge. And I think the reason it's interesting is that if we take our 100 billion gallons of ethanol, that's about 64 billion gallons of gasoline equivalent, which is about 16% of our oil supply in 20 years. If we can't get up to something like that level, then it's going to be very difficult to argue that biofuels are going to be a significant component of a strategic program. And you're going to have to be careful about claiming that biofuels will reduce our oil import dependence and do a couple of other wonderful things. So the question is, what would it take to get to 100 billion gallons of ethanol? Let's just take a quick look at where we are today, and I'm going to show some numbers. They've been shown before, but maybe in a slightly different way. We produced roughly 4 billion gallons of ethanol last year. The U.S. had about 82 million acres planted in corn. Corn crop was about 11 billion bushels. That's about a billion and a half bushels devoted to ethanol. So that's about 11 million acres of our corn crop went to ethanol. But you have to adjust because about 30% of the food value of the corn comes through the process as distillers' grains and still is in the food supply. So if we make that 30% adjustment, we've got about 8 million acres devoted to ethanol in 2005. Now, total U.S. cropland is about 575 million acres. So it's about 1.5%. Now, this is very, very small. And we're in a very comfortable political equilibrium right now because this allows corn state, farm state senators and congressmen to go back and say that the ethanol program is helping to keep farm prices up. But the impact is so small that it's below the radar screen for the average American who doesn't see his food prices really being impacted and thinks in the back of his mind, maybe there's an energy benefit to doing this. Well, okay, this is a comfortable equilibrium, but what happens if we try to move to our 100 billion gallon level? And just as a note, final note, the conservation reserve is 35 million acres. So this is what we've taken out of service. This is basically a very small amount of land that we're messing with here. If we look at corn per acre in the United States on corn land is about 134 bushels. We get 2.8 gallons of ethanol per bushel, so 375 gallons per acre. So the land required for 100 billion gallons would be 267 million acres, but I need to make my adjustment for the distiller's grains. So effectively about 187 million acres, which is about a third of our cropland. Now, obviously, we're not going to do that, okay? That would just simply have way too big an impact on our food supply. Well, let's take a look at cellulose and see if that's any better. Switchgrass today, on average, about 5 dry tons per acre. I think that's a number we've seen before. I don't think people would disagree too much with it. We get about 80 gallons per dry ton, so that's about 400 gallons per acre. So that will require 250 million acres to get our 100 billion gallons. We don't get any food out of growing switchgrass. Okay, so that takes the whole 250 million acres. That's about 45%. So the question is, what actually happens as you try to move from today producing tiny amounts of ethanol up to this level? Now, the ethanol optimists say, well, several things are going to happen. This number is going to go up because we're going to learn to produce a lot more biomass on an acre. Maybe. Maybe not. People will say that the 80 gallons will go up. That may happen, too. We don't really know how much. One of the things we have to remember is that we have never been able to predict technology. It's very easy, as Tad said, to make assumptions about how everything gets better. We really don't know what we'd be able to do with this and whether increasing the biomass yield per acre can only be done with more energy or more irrigation or if there's any way to do this that's really meaningful. What's likely to happen is that as you start mandating more ethanol into the marketplace, the price of food and fuel starts to go up until we hit an equilibrium. And that equilibrium gets to the point where government can't subsidize it anymore, and all of a sudden the increase in food costs comes to the attention of the American public, and they're no longer going to support these ethanol mandates. Now, just as a quick look here, seems to me, from everything I've seen, ethanol cost is about $1 a gallon plus feedstock, you know, plus or minus. Okay, so if the feedstock of and the feedstock cost, if we use corn, is dollars per bushel divided by 2.8 times 70%, which again takes into account the fact that some of the food supply is preserved. So if corn is 2.25 a bushel, which is about where it is today, then you can make ethanol at about 2.45 per gallon of gasoline equivalent. If you drive the price of corn to $5 a bushel, you've made food more expensive, and now your ethanol is costing $3.50 a gallon. If you drive the price of corn to $10 a bushel, ethanol is $5.50 a gallon. So the real question is, how much can you push ethanol into the marketplace and, in fact, have technology stay ahead of you and keep you whole? If you don't get these huge anticipated technological improvements, all that's going to happen is you're going to drive up the price of both fuel and food to the point where we'll stop doing it. Now, we have absolutely no way of knowing what will happen in the future if we do this. We've never been able to predict technology. And we have a lot of experiences in the back. Those of us graybeards who've been around the energy business a long time remember things like fusion, which was going to be commercial by the year 2000, electric cars. All we need to do is just make some improvements in batteries. We had all kinds of things. At one point, nuclear power was going to be too cheap to meter. We simply don't know how to predict these technological advances. Another thing we have to be very careful of is as we start looking farther and farther out into the future, our ability to understand not only what our energy balance looks like, but what the society looks like becomes really questionable. One thing that's fun to do as a kind of a just a mental exercise is put yourself back in the 1860s when Abraham Lincoln was president and assume he had a Secretary of Energy who was asked to plan the future energy economy of the United States. Well, he'd be thinking about railroads, he'd be thinking about use of coal for industrial process heat. He wouldn't know anything about electricity. He wouldn't know anything about automobiles. He'd know about petroleum, but he'd think of it as a fuel for lamps. So the question is, what would he actually be able to think about 50 years ahead? today, I think the pace of technological change is even stronger. And I think we need to be just very careful about thinking about what our energy balance looks like 50 years in the future. My own guess is that not only the way we produce energy, but the way we use energy will be fundamentally transformed in the next 50 years. So I think one of the questions we come down to then is, what are these biofuel mandates doing for us? Well, right now what they're doing for us is they're helping us to sell to the public our farm price support programs. That's basically what they're doing. How high can we drive that, and can we drive that to a point where it actually becomes a strategic component of our energy balance? Well, I think you've heard a number of different views on that, and we ought to discuss that. The last point is, it seems to me we ought to be very careful with ethanol infrastructure mandates. There are some proposals floating around the Hill now to require all cars to be E85 capable, to require Buford, just the major oil companies, of course, to install E85 pumps at half their service stations. These are extremely expensive steps for a fuel which we're not sure we can produce. Okay, let me just toss up one more chart and then I'll be done. If we look at the question of waste biomass, which is often offered as the real solution to not having to compete with the food supply, if you look at Oak Ridge's study of this, they said at $40 a ton, you get 250 million tons of waste biomass at 60 gallons per ton. That's only 15 billion gallons out of our 100. If we look at biodiesel, the entire U.S. supply of oil and fat is about 35 million tons. Billion tons. That's all the soy oil, all the peanut oil, all the corn oil. That's all your salad dressing, all your margarine, all your vegetable oil, everything. At about 7 pounds per gallon, that's about 5 billion gallons. That doesn't mean there aren't some good business opportunities in biofuel, but this is not going to do much to help you get to 100 billion gallons, and you're going to be eating dry salad. So to me, this is really the policy question. Is there a prudent pathway to bring biofuels to the point where they actually make that strategic contribution? What are the technical and what are the economic barriers? So, Doug, I'll turn it back over to you.
Let's see. Thanks, Bruce. So let us open the floor for questions, and if it's specific to a given panelist, please state so, and if not, just open it up and we'll let someone take it as a volunteer, and I think we have microphones to go around the room.
Very informative. Thank you very much. I should state my bias to begin with. I'm Annette Hester. I am Brazilian, and I live in Canada in Alberta. So so I do quite a bit. I'm also associated with CSIS. And I do look at energy markets. So I found it really interesting and was glad that John made a mention of demand. Because it seems, and so did Ted, in the sense that we're not going to solve this, or the United States is not going to solve this by simply looking at supply and not looking at demand. It's just not possible. But as we move forward, I had a few questions. The Brazilian experience, I think, has a lot to offer to the U.S., because it came out of necessity. Brazil didn't start its ethanol program. I mean, he probably would have loved to have a situation where you can do photocells or other things, but he didn't. And he needed oil, and he needed transportation fuel, and he couldn't import. It was during the 70s, and so he developed what he could and what he had land for. And by the way, tropical forest is not where the land is being grown, and that's really not... It's not, sounds good, but it's not what's happening. It is in the state of São Paulo and not exactly tropical forest. But that said, I'm very curious about the statement of the corn potential. I didn't understand the corn potential in terms of energy provider compared to all of the oil in Brazil, so you made a mention, Ted, and I would very much like to understand that a little bit. Also, Bill, you had a slide where you had 30 billion gallons potential for the U.S., 7 billion for Brazil, and some other one for Asia, and I didn't know what that 30 billion meant because you have a production now that is equal to Brazil. Brazil and U.S. Production of ethanol, but I don't know why in the future or what exactly that site represented. And I was outlook forward. And on John Rees, I have a question or a comment. The Brazilian experience right now is that they are transporting gasoline and ethanol in the same pipe. But as you mentioned, gasoline, like products, they can transport product, and they have a major one between Rio and São Paulo that is transporting the two together. But as you mentioned, it's very difficult and extremely corrosive. So if you use in the U.S. a little bit more corrosion and we have a little bit more problems with that, that might be a huge problem. So I was wondering whether your comments went into the product sector also as far as mixing fuels. And last, Bruce, a comment on the agricultural policy. And much agreed at the support. I mean, corn ethanol, corn producers receive the most amount of support of all agriculture in the farm support programs. But what is your view in when we start bringing the distortions that we have found in agricultural markets that have led to an impasse in Doha now into the energy markets? Do you have some comments on that? Thank you.
I guess I got the first question, right? Okay. Brazil is a country of about 170, let's say, 6 million people. Is that a fair assessment? America is a country of 300 million people, plus minus. Brazil is using, in fact, petroleum in an amount that is less than 5 exajoules per year, which means that the entire amount of all petroleum used in Brazil is less than the amount of energy produced as U.S. corn. That's the statement I made. And I can give you the historical plot of it over the last 40 years. Brazilians use mostly diesel fuel. Gasoline is, in fact, less than half of diesel fuel. And then ethanol is 40% in its energy of the gasoline. So that these are the numbers. Okay, and so in order for us to compare Brazil with the United States, ratioing the populations, you and I would have to drive our car once in every 2 weeks, okay, and then 13 days we walk, okay, and then we can start making the comparisons with Brazil. That's the first point. The second point, it's commonly believed that sugarcane is not grown in the tropical forest, and it isn't. It is grown in the Cerrado region, in the northwest and southwest and the northeast Cerrado region. What happens is that these sugarcane plantations are being expanded. They encroach on other crops which are competing with the sugarcane, such as soybeans, and it is the soybean fields that are being now cut into the Amazon forest. And over the last, 20 years, the area of the Amazon forest cut, much of it converted to agriculture and to pastures, is exactly equal to the area devoted to corn, 30 million hectares, 300,000 square kilometers. Okay, and these are satellite information, so, you know. Yes. Oh, absolutely, but no disagreement. No. Yes.
It's not the producing.
Yes.
The encroachment that has happened in the Amazon, and it does happen.
Yes.
It is completely separate from
sugarcane
and ethanol. So
well, is it? Is it? Okay. You see, if you expand land use to do one thing, then you have to, and you want to produce other things, then you have to produce them elsewhere. So I would actually disagree with you that it is completely unrelated.
I would just like to jump in real quick. This whole discussion is a red herring. My goal is to begin to show that there's a whole lot less difference between Tad Patsick and my numbers than people think, And so my first point of agreement with Tad is Brazil is not the model for the United States. And to suggest that Brazilian petroleum independence is the model for U.S. energy independence is really absurd. To suggest in the same vein as a lot of people have that simply importing Brazilian ethanol is going to be the answer is also absurd because we are already making as much or more ethanol than Brazil makes total. So I'd just like to say put Brazil aside and let's focus on the United States and other aspects of the global energy problem.
I wasn't trying to suggest this, but to suggest that you have no lessons to learn from 25 years of ethanol.
I agree with you. There are lessons to learn, but
I'm not suggesting that one model
always things to learn. Bill, do you have a response?
Yes. So the second question was about the question of estimates. So estimates, by their nature, are not correct. We have to integrate them. So in the Brazil case, there's competing things taking place, and we don't know how best to judge those. So will Brazil become a net exporter over the next? Right, so there's the issue of will or will not Brazil start to export on a significant scale. So that number could change depending on the answer to that question. The other element that we always struggle with in Brazil is Brazil's industrial model for biofuels is a balance of sugar output versus ethanol output. And recently with the price of sugar going up, the ethanol output has actually gone down slightly. So we tried to take those into account. So those estimates were based on because we... No, it does not. Okay. So those are the competing things. And then there's always the unknown, which is there are efforts ongoing to look at productivity increases in sugarcane. And how will those play out? So there's a whole lot of variables in Brazil, and so we had to make some kind of a call that said, what do we think our best estimate is based on all of those? Some go up, some go down.
John Reese, do you have a comment on the infrastructure?
The next question then was about pipelines. You know, an ethanol can be transported through a dedicated pipeline, but that's not really the kind of pipelines we have in the United States. We have multi-product pipelines that move, you know, gasoline, diesel, jet, you know, everything kind of in sequence. One of the big difficulties of moving ethanol in a mixed with gasoline through a pipeline is ethanol's affinity for water. What ethanol will do it will move out of the gasoline and into the water, what we call phase separation. So the end product of that is water with a lot of ethanol in it and gasoline that would not be fit for purpose to use because the ethanol is used in gasoline, same reformulated gasoline. The ethanol is used to provide octane to help reduce toxics by dilution. And so if you had the ethanol out of solution and move into the water, you've got then the gasoline part of it that really is not a fit-for-purpose fuel. So that's why you have to be very careful with water management with ethanol, and that's why the ethanol is moved separately to the terminals by truck, rail, or barge. The hydrocarbon part, what we call BOBs, it's a blend stock for oxygenate blending for reformulated gasoline, that moves by pipeline, and then we mix it in the rack as it goes into the truck to be very careful about the water issue.
Bruce, you had the last question.
Yeah, I think just this question of farm supports, I think any economist would tell you that there's no valid reason for the United States, Europe, and Japan to support farmers. At the time of the American Revolution, 98% of us were farmers, and it's now less than 2%. And people are still living off the painful images of the Depression when people were thrown off their land. Farmers in the United States now have higher incomes than the population as a whole. So we can play this game because every state gets two senators, and there's a lot of farm states, and the political balance makes it this way. But you can only play this game until the American public perceives that food prices are not going up. Once you start driving up food prices, this game is over. And it seems to me very difficult, barring some extraordinary unforeseen technological advancement, that you can drive ethanol production much above its current level before people start to take notice of the fact that they're taking home less at the grocery store, and then the game is up. So I think the answer to your question is there is no valid economic reason for the industrial countries to be subsidizing their farmers, and it is a legitimate grievance of the developing countries that sooner or later we're going to have to fix. This may actually help us fix it.
Let me reiterate just guidance here. If you please identify yourself and to whom you're addressing the question, and please pose your comment as a question. And go ahead, please. We'll work our way around.
Mike Maul from the U.S. Department of State. The example of Brazil, of energy independence, is really noteworthy. And I was wondering if, before we leave the Brazilian example, the panel could address other developing nations in the tropics and whether lessons learned from Brazil could be applied to other developing nations.
It's a minefield. So basically, let's start from Brazil again. Brazil, in fact, is or will become a major exporter of ethanol to both Sweden and Japan, because Sweden has decreed a sort of a carbon-free economy, and therefore they're using somebody else's resources, and they feel good about it. When it comes to us recolonizing Africa and swaths of Asia, we're very good at it. We're calling it no longer recolonization. We're calling it development. We're calling it green energy. We call it sustainability. We're doing all the same. We're just for example, when the Chinese started to care about their own forests, they it's forbidden to cut trees in China, the Chinese logging companies moved to Myanmar, right? And they're pretty much on their way to cutting a lot of forest there. Then they're moving to Indonesia, and they're going to cut a whole lot of forest in Borneo and on other islands. And so basically, the experience of the developing world is to become a big plantation of industrial plants for us so that we can feel better. Okay, so that's sort of my short.
Let me offer one comment. There are very few other developing countries, particularly in the tropic belt, that have such a wealth of history in biofuels or in alternative transportation fuels. The one that comes to mind, if you look across the IEA data, where there's currently a significant amount of activity, and it's mostly toward biodiesel, is Malaysia, where they do palm oil-based production of biodiesel. And the country, the government, as of about 2 months ago, has put a halt on licensing of new plants until they have further analysis to confirm whether or not they're entering into a competitive environment between fuels and food. And that's about the only other experience that has gained a fair amount of attention in the last two or three months that I'm aware of. But Bruce, maybe you have some other comments.
Yeah. Doug, if it's okay, let me also try to address. So from my perspective, I'm speaking personally from what I've learned over the years. I don't think the Brazil situation is tells you that it can be replicated somewhere else. Unless you go back to the basis for why Brazil was able to do that, and there may be places in the world where there's a unique combination of resources and ability. So as an example, there are areas in Africa, I think John Shell, I believe, is in certain countries in Africa where there's huge reserves of gas that have no value to the local economy other than to the extent some of that can be transported externally, and there's some return to the country. If there were technologies to convert that gas into some more storable and transportable fuel, parts of Africa could reproduce Brazil in a completely different mechanism. But I think it's extremely specific to a country or an individual resource base of the combination of land and labor costs and available raw material. So I don't think it's a generic learning other than looking at all of the components of the equation and see can they be converted into a path that would allow for that type of system to exist.
Hi, is this working? My name is Rob Bradley from the World Resources Institute. I apologize. I missed a couple of the early presentations, so excuse me if this was answered earlier. I really wanted to come back on a point that Dr. Everett raised towards the end of his presentation, which is about the strategy the U.S. takes in framing its biofuels policy. And the striking thing at the moment is that you have state-level policy pushing towards a sort of mandated 10% or some given level of mixed ethanol. And federal policy seems to revolve, or proposals seem to revolve, largely around deploying the infrastructure necessary for E85. Your reflections on the potential scale of production of biofuels suggest that both of those are certainly not necessary. You can deploy E85 in some regions, or you can do a mandated amount across the country. Given that, do you have some insight into how that sort of interplay at the moment between federal policy proposals and state-level activity is playing out and is likely to play out in framing policy in Washington? But secondly, do you know of analysis that's been done, particularly around the advisability of promoting flexible fuel vehicles, which clearly are aimed at an E85-based strategy and are being promoted heavily by some car companies, principally as a way of not merely derailing potential tightening of CAFE standards, but actually, of course, they are a major loophole in enabling them to meet the CAFE standards today while maintaining low-efficiency fleets? Thank you.
Thanks. It's a very good question. I think the best way to answer that is that we are still in the mode, at both state and federal level, of farm policies disguised as energy policy. And as I said, that works only to the extent that it's done at a very small scale. And I think there are a lot of states that would love to have the price of corn go up 25 cents a bushel or 50 cents a bushel, and that would help. And if you can disguise that by convincing the broader population this is good for them from an energy standpoint, that all fits together nicely from a political standpoint. The question is, what begins to happen as you drive ethanol up to enough to really make a difference? Now, my guess is that that's going to be hard to do. And unless you're really confident that you can get close to that 100 billion gallon level, mandating E85 flex fuel vehicles makes no sense at all, because you're going to do what's happened with U.S. government fleets of flex fuel vehicles. You pay for the flexible fuel, and then they burn gasoline. Okay, and that's simply an absolute dead loss. So this is a game between state and federal levels which is not going to be difficult or significant until somebody tries to drive these levels to something that's important. In which case, I think the whole thing is going to come to a grinding halt. That's my personal guess.
Yeah, can I add a few comments around state and federal? The energy bill that Congress passed last year has a federal renewable fuel standard, started at 4 billion gallons in 2006, ramps up to 7.5 billion gallons in 2012. And it also has associated with a credit program, and these are the rules that EPA just published, the proposed rules that EPA published just last week. But one of the underlying themes of that whole program was that the federal government would set a target, and that through the use of a credit trading program, the use of ethanol could be used in the most efficient way, and wherever it makes the most sense. The state programs are really starting, they erode that flexibility that Congress provided in the federal energy bill by requiring, you know, specific types of fuels in specific states. And this is a issue that, you know, the country and the industry has been grappling with for many years. We call it the boutique fuel issue. We have many different types of fuels around the country. Overall, boutique fuels and all these different requirements reduce the efficiency of the system. But if there's some kind of disruption, perhaps a pipeline break or a refinery goes down or something like that, that's when the boutique fuels really pose a challenge, because we cannot move fuels easily from one area to the other to supply the fuels that consumers demand. So the state initiatives are really imposing additional unique fuel requirements like that, and are yet another boutique fuel.
If I just may add one comment, because this is actually a very good question that would require a thorough discussion. So if you were to really increase the mileage of the U.S. passenger car fleet, no, forget the SUVs, anything else, you would actually eliminate the need for 12 billion gallons of ethanol. Okay, that's one thing. So basically, a small technical improvement, pressure sensors in the tires, have a larger impact on energy consumption than all biofuels right now, and by the 2012. That's one. Two, people will vote with their pockets. I have plotted, being an engineer, the ratio of stock, of value of stock of Toyota to Ford over the last 5 years, and the parameter I used was the price of oil. And as it happens, it started from about 4 in 2001, then there was a period of instability where it was slightly increasing, then it jumped, and that's a new regime, and now it's about 18. And so what happens is that people are noticing, are seeing through all these ploys of talking, you know, live green, drive yellow, the other way around, and they're actually buying efficient cars. Okay. And so the market will tell our automakers to straighten up or go out of business. So I think that's a pretty straightforward answer here.
I'm Ken Austin with the Treasury Department. Just one comment, actually, just to correct a factual error. This idea that Brazil has become energy independent by using biofuels is completely, totally, utterly false.
Yes.
They did it the old-fashioned way by discovering oil. In 1995, Brazil was producing about 700,000 barrels of oil a day. Now it's about 1.7 million barrels of oil per day, a million barrel increase in 10 years. In that same 10-year period, on an old barrel of oil equivalent basis, I think they've increased ethanol production by about 24,000 barrels.
Right.
So it's about 97-98% of that it was done by discovering oil. And even if you throw in all the ethanol, it's only about 10-12% of their liquid fuel needs. So it really just – that's a myth, a mistake at best.
Hi, I'm Reed Detchen with the Energy Future Coalition. To take some of Tad's cuteness at the end, I think we've had a little episode of strawman-itis here and silver bulletology. I think one of the things that comes up again and again in this discussion is because biofuels can't supply 100% of X or Y, therefore it can't be of any value at all. Which seems completely preposterous to me. I think John's line about silver buckshot is exactly right, which is that we need to do many things concurrently, and each of these can contribute in their own way. I think another thing that frequently comes up is a confusion between energy balance and petroleum balance. I think that there would be no disagreement on the panel that the petroleum balance of biofuels is very positive, and so I think we ought to be cognizant of that. Finally, I want to correct some impressions that Dr. Everett gave at the end about the effect of demand for biofuels potentially on the price of corn. I think that the corn industry itself would say that its upward capability is somewhere in the nature of 15 to 20 billion gallons out of the 80 to 100 that is generally thought to be the target. But the idea that that would have a dramatic pressure on food prices is just wrong. What has been the problem of American agriculture for the last 100 years? It's been overproduction. And the reason is that yields continue to rise year after year, and to say that we can't predict continued yield increases is to ignore history. In fact, it costs in real life a dollar to a dollar 20 without subsidy to produce a gallon of ethanol from corn. So the idea that we're starting at $1.50 and we're going to go to $5 is preposterous. And finally, the relationship to food prices, it's a well-documented fact that the share of food prices represented by the farm input is less than 20%. Some say less than 5%. It's marketing, it's transportation, it's packaging, it's advertising. And so I think that the idea that we're going to have a dramatic impact on food prices is just not correct.
Could I just make a comment to start? And I'll go to Reed's first point. Silver buckshot being an interesting way of looking at it. The way we frame this debate and how we approach it becomes extremely important. We clearly believe, and I showed the energy, world energy supplies broken by transportation and stationary on purpose. So we have a situation for transportation energy where we either choose not to drive or not to transport anything, or we need to have a future where on a strategic basis there are more options available to us. So we view the future of transportation fuel as becoming more differentiated. The term niche suggests it's not important. Any differentiated fuel, when it first is available, will appear to be a niche. The question becomes, how big might it become? And that's the subject of a whole bunch of social, political, and economic equations that have to be explored. But you can't explore them as a digital world. You have to explore them in degrees. So framing this issue as a sort of either-or, I completely support Reed's position. It's not an either-or. Transportation fuels, the future of transportation fuels will be more differentiated than it is today. That solution will be on the transportation energy supply side. It will also be on the vehicle side. So one of the things that if we had one of the vehicle manufacturers here, they would likely be able to speak to the fact that they have modeled what the future of CO2 looks like. And there's different scenarios of the future of CO2. And one of those scenarios, and perhaps the scenario that has the biggest impact on reducing the impact of transportation on CO2, is the combination of biofuels and hybrid vehicles. So the solution space is not unidimensional. It's multidimensional. It has components related to the fuels. We need more, not fewer options. We need more, not fewer options around vehicles and the technologies that drive those vehicles. And you also have to consider that implementation of these solutions is not digital as well. So a solution that might be better but would take 50 years to implement is really not going to have the kind of impact that we need to have. So I do believe the way we frame the debate becomes extremely important to how we view it and then how we look at policy opposite that, because if we view policy as digital, it isn't. We're not in a digital world, and I think it's important that we recognize that.
I'd like to build on the one word that Bill used that's also in the name of this organization, and that's strategic. We can easily lose perspective getting caught up in factoids and details about what Brazil's doing or what corn grain farmers are doing or what ADM's getting out of, being able to make more ethanol. And that's all a lot of that in the here and now and if you'll pardon the expression, in the weeds. We need to take a step back and look at the question strategically. And when I do that, and I hear numbers from TAD, for example, that 105 exajoules is a lot of sperm whales and a lot of energy, I'm in complete agreement. He and I are singing from the same, songbook. Then this question of, where are the roles for things like biofuels becomes something that you can talk about. The other common connection, which I think we're all agreeing with here, is that efficiency and demand-side management of energy in some ways is one of the most powerful levers. My data shows that. Obviously, Tad Patzick's data shows that. So what we need to help people with is to be able to move forward in this 30 to 50-year view of where we're going energy-wise. And by the way, whether or not it's possible to project technology or to make projections about where we are going to be 50 years from now, if we just throw up our hands and say we can't do it, that's a cop-out. The fact of the matter is it's going to take us 30 to 50 years to make the kind of shift away from a petroleum and a fossil economy, and therefore we're forced to deal with that question whether we feel comfortable with it or not.
Okay, let me take a shot just at clarifying a few things. First of all, I did not intend my remarks to mean that I'm an opponent of biofuels. there is a very big difference between saying, as I think several people have this morning, that biofuels is a potential source of additional fuel for the country and that it's one of many, and then switching over and saying, I am going to demand that people take very expensive steps through legislative action, such as mandating flex fuel vehicles and mandating ethanol in the marketplace, on the promise that it will ultimately get to the point where it will make such and such a contribution to our strategic energy balance. Then you're in a different realm, okay? Now, my point was not that biofuels can't be a part of the energy mix. Of course they can. Doesn't mean that they shouldn't be a part of the energy mix. All I'm saying, and again getting to this gentleman's point, where we are today with the amount of biofuel that you can grow on an acre of land, if we start forcing into the marketplace additional increments of ethanol to move us up in the direction of 100 billion gallons a year, at some point you're likely to find that the cost of food is starting to go up to the point where the American people won't support you anymore. Now, the optimistic view of this, and this is a possible scenario, is that technology keeps us ahead of this and that we can, in fact, move ourselves up to 100 billion gallons. I'm skeptical of that, although, as this gentleman said, it is true that we increase yields of plants over the years. One way we increase the yield of plants is by throwing vast amounts of energy down on the ground. And when you're increasing food yield by using energy, that's one calculation. When you're increasing energy yield by using energy, that's a different and more complicated challenge. So my point is not that we can't do this, but I'm urging caution when we start mandating very expensive steps through legislation that you may find yourself in a very difficult situation way short of your 100 billion gallons. And if that's the case, then you have to be careful what you're promising the American people in terms of the energy policy benefits of doing that. Okay, that's my point.
Bruce, I could just one point. Flexible fuel vehicles are sold by manufacturers at the same cost as regular vehicles because the difference in cost is so trivial to them. It's $100 or less per vehicle. Now, I would not call that a very expensive step for getting off the petrol.
Yes, but they don't have fuel to drive on.
But the point is, the thing we have to be very careful of is we sell 18 million cars a year in the United States. If it's $100 a car, that's $2 billion. Now, you can say right now the car companies will sell a few of these as loss leaders, but ultimately the American consumer is going to pay another $100 for his car. Now, if he thinks he's getting a benefit out of that, fine. But if he's not getting any benefit out of it, it's simply dead loss. Now, we're a very rich country with a very prosperous economy. We can afford a whole lot of those things, but not an infinite amount of them.
But how would you establish a fueling infrastructure without cars to drive?
Well, the first thing I would do is try to establish my confidence level that I could produce enough ethanol to require that fueling infrastructure.
I'm going to encourage us to take the rest of that particular debate offline. Yes. And move to another question, if we would. Thanks.
Joe Masita from Gibbs Energy. I'd like to address the point that Bill made about the decentralized nature of these resources and the fact it's not just fossil economy we have to get away from, but it's a centralized economy. The 100 exajoules you're talking about, over about 30 of them are losses from central electrical generation. Once you look at a distributed system, as opposed to a huge centralized, for instance, Fischer-Tropsch system, you start to have recoverable energy. And so you can't look at just fossil fuels, or renewable fuels, just in the transport picture. 30 years ago, our economy was 50% efficient. It's now 36% efficient. Transport stayed constant. The residential, commercial, and industrial have actually increased. And it's just the increased demand of the electrical sector that has led to losses as high as they are. If you're going to manage demand by distributing systems and going to some level of cogeneration where you can recover instead of, say, 55% of the centralized FD plant, go up to 80%, 90% by doing bi-fuel or do thermal recovery and electrical generation, you affect that demand enormously. I'm curious if any of the panelists have looked at the effect of that decentralization, the ability to generate more than one product while you're making the fuel.
Hmm. That's a very interesting point. And in fact, this deserves to be looked at, the decentralized production of electricity. I would disagree that the current losses in transmission lines are 30 exajoules. I think they're less. But having said that, there is a huge future of decentralization of both biofuel production and use and energy production. And in fact, don't get me wrong, I'm also for some level of biofuel production which is sustainable by nature and by the world, and that biofuel production and use should come together. So there's nothing wrong with a farmer driving his tractor on the biofuel he produced or was producing in his neighborhood. What I object to is creating a national infrastructure to drive on 5 billion gallons of something while we are using 140 billion of something else. And I agree totally with Bruce that that's just not very not a very good decision.
We'll go ahead and move on. Thanks.
Good morning. Gar Luft from the Institute for the Analysis of Global Security. I'm not a big fan of corn as the best feedstock for ethanol production, but I need to put the fact, the record straight on that we started a discussion about the balance between food and energy from a very, very bad misallocation of resources in the United States. 60% of our corn is used for animal feed. Anybody that had a discussion with a cow knows that cows are not supposed to eat corn. So I find it very ironic that we are beginning to, we want to grow grass in order to feed our cars, whereas it is the cows that need to eat the grass. And I think that we need to really straighten this out. Cows are not built genetically, biologically, to eat corn. That's one thing. The more important thing I want to raise here is the issue of the fact that we are focusing our debate on biofuels on biological conversions of biomass. Which to me is also another thing that needs to be straightened out. There are many ways to convert biomass, and I think that there's a lot of focus on the biological conversions, which may be very beneficial to us, and I think they need to be pursued. However, there is chemistry in the world too, and we know that chemistry is more easier to do than biology, and I think that there are very interesting approaches that we haven't heard about. Number one is municipal solid waste. Municipal solid waste is a growing industry. In fact, not only that 60% of our garbage is biomass, but it also it costs us more and more money to get rid of it. So we need to, and there are a number of very interesting technologies that can allow us to utilize this, something that we want to get rid of very badly to produce fuel and fuel components, number one. Number two, our entire discussion on ethanol should change from ethanol to alcohol. Ethanol is not the only alcohol that exists in the world. In fact, my recent visit in China, I learned that 8 provinces in China are now shifting to methanol. And in fact, they're using it through gasification, gasifying biomass instead of converting into through biological processes. And we don't hear about it here. Methanol is an alcohol. It can run in flexible fuel cars. Please don't tell me that it should not be in the market because it's toxic, because we're not talking about a beverage here. And I think that if we really are serious about alternative fuels, we need to open the market to all the alternative fuels and opt for full flexible fuel flexibility and not pick one alcohol over the other.
Thank you for the comment. Responses?
I actually, there's a couple of good points here, but again, very briefly. So corn, in fact, I think it's more than 60% used for feed. It's around 70%, but that's okay, 60 or 70. What we have created now is a system where we have decoupled feeding animals from production of the feed. Cows cannot stand corn. They become sick. They have to be fed with antibiotics, and in fact, their liver gets really sick, and they will die ultimately out of this. And so now we have two waste streams, one waste stream from the fields, another waste stream from the cows, which are completely decoupled. It used to be that cows grew where the fields were, and that's not anymore true. So there are, I think, very good ways of mending this problem, and in fact feeding cows on grass a lot more than on corn. They would gain less weight, but I think we can live with it as well. Let's see. Now I forgot your second, because there was a long... you made another very good point. That's okay. I'll stop here.
I'd like to build on the comment from the gentleman in the audience. One of my first slides was this notion that sustainable development means minimal technological prosthetic dependence. We can't build a house of cards in which maybe we're doing something weird to feed cows and we're doing something else to make energy, when it requires a broad systems perspective on where we're going. And again, this is where it's a strategic issue. I completely agree. We need to get up and out of the weeds here and think about what the whole system, from food to energy, needs to look like. Real quickly, I think the other big issue that I heard brought up was what I'll call technological tunnel vision. We absolutely fall very rapidly into tunnel vision about technology, so that biofuels today in this country has become synonymous with ethanol or biodiesel, and even our definition of biodiesel is a very, very narrow, restricted definition of what could be biodiesel. So yes, there's a lot of thermochemical technology out there. I'll debate whether chemistry is easier than biology, but we can do that offline. In fact, biology is chemistry. But the fact of the matter is that we need to use all of these technological levers in the areas where they're best suited. Some feedstocks are going to be better suited for biological processing. Other feedstocks are going to be better suited for thermal processing. And in fact, a lot of analysis that we have done has said, you know what? You get your best bang for your buck when you optimize the combination of biological and thermal processing to make a mix of fuels that is far more energy efficient than the 50% efficiency that we now have today in just a biological cellulose to ethanol process.
And I guess I have to make just one comment, because I think my comments were consistent with yours about the issue of multiple solutions. So we're completely in alignment, and those can come from chemical pathways or it can come from biological pathways. But the idea that ethanol is the only biofuel, or biodiesel defined the way that it is, which is extremely restrictive. Policy should not make those kinds of distinctions. They ought to look at these as multiple possible solutions, some of which exist today, new ones of which we don't know about today, but give people the incentive to work on them. So I think
And in my view, Grafs, the Fischer-Tropsch fuel was made out of methanol, and you will note that it was always more efficient than making cellulosic ethanol. Okay, so, and there was electricity cogeneration with it.
So I think we're in agreement that ethanol now should be replaced by alcohol. But we'll move on to the next question if we could.
Yeah, my name is Darren Lovas, and I'm with the Natural Resources Defense Council. And Bill, I like what you say about consumer choice, because this is in an increasing amount of markets, there are niches, there are more choices for consumers. But when a consumer pulls up to a gas pump at the vast majority of retailers in this country, they have only one choice, petroleum-derived fuels. And I think there's more and more heartburn about that among consumers, particularly given recent price trends. In that vein, I'd love to hear more about biobutanol and what the plans are for commercialization, how far along we are, what the feedstocks might be, and that kind of thing. So that's my first question to you specifically. My second question to the panel is, we've heard plenty about what policies you would like to see not enacted because of potential unintended consequences. Could you name policies that you would like to see enacted since we are here in D.C., and not just on alternative liquid fuels, but on the efficiency side as well, which I couldn't agree more, is a huge part of the equation. And as a matter of fact, I hope CSIS is going to have a panel on the demand side to complement this supply side look, which has been very instructional. So thank you.
I can easily take the last piece, which is, yes, there will be a panel on the demand side.
Go ahead, Bill. So let me comment on the first part of the question, which was about biobutanol. And I can only comment here those things that we have said publicly. So I hope you appreciate that there's major elements of our plans that I can't speak about publicly. We are focusing our efforts initially in Europe. We've said that, specifically the UK. Europe in a very different situation than the U.S. is today. So the U.S. has put in place the infrastructure for ethanol blending. Europe has not done that. Largely, Europe's use of ethanol is as in the form of ETBE, which can be blended as a normal component of gasoline. So what we've said publicly is we're working with current generation technology. We are working on improving that technology so that the technology for making butanol will evolve over time. Our focus initially will be in Europe. With the introduction of that can be in the form of a blending agent independent of or separately from any other biofuels, or it may come in the form of a co-blend with other biofuels. So that's what we can say now. So it will go through an evolutionary process. As you can imagine, a new technology is not immediately at the state of performance and economics that you need it to be ultimately competitive. So that's the elements of the program that we need to work on. We do view it as a technology that will be applicable anywhere in the world for which sugar is being fermented into alcohols. So it is not a unique process in the sense that someone who's doing one thing today couldn't consider converting to doing that in the future. So does that help? Is that okay? On the issue of policy, if I can make just a policy question. So one of the things that that we would support, and I think the EPA's, I haven't read that the report yet, but different biofuels will have different energy densities. And to the extent that there are elements of policy that are important to the introduction of these technologies, if they were adjusted on a BTU basis rather than a gallon basis. A gallon is an insufficient mechanism for measurement, but on a BTU basis. So if someone comes up with another technique to convert agricultural carbon into a transportation fuel, the incentive should be on the basis of the BTU that fuel brings, not on the basis of a volumetric measurement of that.
I want to follow up on the policy question. I could get in trouble since as an employee of a national lab, I'm not supposed to have an opinion about policy. But let me talk about policy from a strategic perspective. It's things like what Bill just mentioned, focusing on the energy that's being delivered, not some arbitrary gallon, is an example of a policy that is not getting focused on the actual functional societal need that we have. I'm a firm believer in the notion that if there's going to be policy, it has to be built around sound analysis and science in terms of the sustainable benefits to society. So an arbitrary tax incentive does not achieve that. And in fact, it pulls you into the trap of talking about special interest politics. In terms of where policy ought to go, then I really think that what I find most surprising is how little interest there is from the government in truly understanding the sustainability of different technologies and different approaches for where we're taking energy. We're making decisions blind, and we're leaving ourselves in a situation where Tad Patzick and I can sort of argue at each other instead of resolving the sustainability issues that need to get answered. I'll get off my soapbox now.
I have a very simple policy suggestion. So if our president were to stand up in front of the American people and say, look, we're going to increase efficiency of the American transportation system, the entire thing, trucks, cars, trains, planes, by 50%, that's going to eliminate 7 million barrels of oil per day with no possibility or need to replace them. Here are the steps we're going to undertake to do that. And there are several steps we can do. One, producing more efficient cars. Another one would be introducing mass transit systems and train transportation. Another one would be to moving cities inwards as opposed to outwards. So there are many policy issues that could be achieved in the next 20 years that would have a tremendous impact on how unsustainable this country, in fact, is. And somehow, nobody's doing this. And somehow, I have to say, when I said I don't get any money for this, that's for a reason. Because nobody's interested in such thinking and really getting to the bottom of it and introducing a common language in which we could all talk and understand each other when we talk about this variety, this buckshot of future solutions. And that's so needed. And we are so confused right now as the nation that, you know, I don't sleep very well at night because of it.
I'm going to come over and hug you there, Tad.
If I could just add, you know, we think that we need to take a broad view here. And energy diversity of energy sources is very important. Of course, petroleum, but we're also involved in solar, wind, gas to liquids, converting methane to distillate fuels, second-generation biofuels, clean coal technologies, and hydrogen. Ultimately, we're going to need all these, and the diversity of energy supplies is a very important principle.
Let me offer one contrarian viewpoint here. I think that studying these problems is an extraordinarily important aspect of this. But we have to remember that studies give us insight, not answers. We do not want to get caught in the trap of believing that we can plan our future or plan our society. This has been tried before. Anybody here from the old Soviet Union?
I am. No, okay. From Poland.
From Poland. Okay. So Tad will attest this. And we have to be very careful. And that's why I think we need to look at policy as a light touch, directional type of instrument and not as a planning instrument. At the end of the day, we get our answers not from studies but from the marketplace. The marketplace is the only instrument that we have that takes into account in a mercilessly objective way all of the complex factors that are involved in making these decisions.
A couple more questions?
I'm Shirley Neff. I'm with the Center for Energy, Marine Transportation, and Public Policy at Columbia University. But I used to be with the Senate Energy Committee when the deal was cut on the renewable fuel standard. And just a little point of historical reference, especially for my friends in the oil industry. The ethanol interests wanted a national market because they thought if they didn't have a guaranteed national market, then they would wind up with their only supporters being in the Midwest again, and the oil industry would do everything it could, you know, to squelch the program. I tried to propose that we at least have the mandate in pads 2 and 3 in the areas where ethanol was produced, not in the RFG markets. And the oil industry met and concluded that, gee, some companies wouldn't have to do as much as others, and so they opposed it. So basically, between the oil industry and the ethanol interests, we now have a national market that people are complaining about. Whereas I talk to people in California and on the East Coast where they're concerned about, you know, levels of blending and potential, you know, emission issues, and you're getting all sorts of different policy proposals at the state level. Well, you know, if we'd had a more rational approach in looking at how we could ramp up these fuels in a way that, you know, we'd have the vehicles to use them so that there would be more flexibility, I think we wouldn't have as many problems as we do now. But it's always the parochial interests of the different constituency groups that lead to these sorts of outcomes. But on the issue of providing incentives based on BTU content as opposed to or how we provide incentives to drive new fuels into the market, one of the problems that the tax writing committees have is that if the, and this was a big issue with respect to biodiesel, depending on what the chemical structure was that qualified for a credit, if it's too broad so that you can produce it, say, from petroleum directly, and that was a concern with some of the formulations, then it winds up being a huge budget buster, and everybody could, you know, just through a transformation, qualify for a larger tax credit. So there's got to be something a little more sophisticated than that. I don't know what the solution is, but that was a big problem from the tax standpoint, is how do you structure this so that you don't open this massive loophole, as we had actually with the SynFuels program.
My comments about BTU were based on the renewable carbon content of the fuel, not the total carbon content of the fuel.
I'm just telling
and
you that
is a measurable. That is a measurable figure.
Mm-hmm. If you think there's a good way to measure it, then it would be good.
Carbon 14 dating tells you whether the carbon came from agriculture or came from oil. It's a very measurable thing. So ETBE only has two carbons that come from renewable carbon. We would argue that any incentive ought to be on the BTU of those two carbons, not the entire molecule. So that my comments were never meant to provide a loophole. I don't want the loophole. It ought to be related to the BTU content of the renewable carbon, and that is a measurable number.
Let's take a couple of last questions, and then we'll wrap up.
My name is George Taylor. I'm with a private energy research foundation in Palo Alto, California. Let me address a question to John, but it's a little technical. John Sheehan. But it's a little technical, so I don't want to cause a rat hole if it's not something that's readily available. But I've read quite a few articles about what it costs. And let me shift the focus from the crop growing side to the actual ethanol and biofuel production side. Because what I'm confused about in the entire argument is that I know there's been a great deal of debate between articles by Pimentel and Patzik versus people from USDA, Shapuri, and people from Argonne and yourself. But I noticed one area of agreement, for instance, on corn ethanol is that it takes about 70% as much energy as comes out in the ethanol to actually go through the production process for the ethanol for corn. But that's starting with something that has sugars in it. So my thought is that when you start with switchgrass or anything else that's actually much more cellulosic, that's much more difficult to produce a fuel out of, it's actually more work because it doesn't start with something that's as close to alcohol in the first place, it would seem that the cost of the production process would only be greater. And what I've read from several sources, but not a lot, on the web, is that the actual cost of steam and electricity to go through the process to produce the ethanol from a cellulosic source is greater than the content that's in the ethanol when it's finished. And the primary source of that energy today, I think, is natural gas. And you can imagine that as natural gas becomes more expensive in the future, you might switch and use coal instead. But my question is, do you agree with the observation that it may, in fact, cost more energy in terms of natural gas to produce cellulosic ethanol than you get in the ethanol when you're finished, or any other kind of alcohol from cellulose? And if so, would it make sense for us to go back and reexamine the question to say, should we try to use natural gas as a fuel directly or try to convert it directly into some more usable liquid kind of fuel rather than going through cropland as an intermediary and then coming back to a fuel?
Actually, a very good question that gets into some definitional problems that I think have caused some of the confusion in the energy balance discussion. In the interest of full disclosure, I have to say I don't yet exactly know what the energy balance of a cellulosic ethanol plant is yet because it hasn't been built yet. What I do have are thermodynamically sound engineering designs based on best available laboratory and pilot scale data that can tell me something about the yield and performance and energy demands of a cellulosic ethanol plant. The big issue here is that you would never derive the energy for a cellulosic ethanol plant from fossil fuel. That is a silly notion. The fact of the matter is that in addition to the sugars that are in there in the case of an ethanol plant, and we can talk about thermochemical processing as well, there's lignin. Lignin is a high BTU content material that is the fuel source for the facility. Now, if we drew a fossil energy balance around a plant that burned natural gas and ignored the lignin, it would have a terrible energy balance. And in fact, that's 2002 study that I cited from Patzik and Pimentel did just that. I think there is also a question of, and I don't think we can answer it here, about, you know, how efficient is a corn ethanol plant? My understanding of those numbers is that the energy efficiency of converting the starch in corn to ethanol is higher than our design efficiencies for the cellulosic process, which fits what you said. Cellulosic materials are harder to process than the starch materials. Currently, it takes more energy, or you have some more losses in that process to do that. But that's my sort of convoluted answer to that question.
Okay. How about if we go to one last question, and then we'll wrap up, please.
Thanks. Rob Bradley again from the World Resources Institute. Couple of just very quick thoughts on this question of the interrelation between sort of biofuels and wider systems. One is that we've discussed a little bit where policy might go, but the fact is that at the moment the promotion of flex fuels is based on the undermining of efficiency standards in vehicles. One estimate is that the big three have avoided in over the last 6 or 7 years about $1 billion in fines by offsetting flex fuel vehicles against their CAFE standards. In the meantime, of course, that's meant more oil imports for the United States with all of the sort of corollary impacts that brings. So one of the questions we need to ask ourselves is, while the policy framework remains like this, will flex fuel vehicles ultimately bring benefits that offset the damage that they're bringing today? And that's something to think about. Another is that if we didn't have a system of agriculture that was so geared around maximizing corn production and then trying to offload it, we maybe wouldn't be using corn syrup in so many products, Americans wouldn't be so heavy, and it wouldn't take so much energy to move them around.
Well, this somewhat brings us back to the sperm whale visual of earlier today. A lot of varied comments, a lot of very good questions. I would encourage you to please help me thank the panel again. Thank you for your attention. Also remind you of upcoming dates, the 28th, and then look for future announcements for the next sessions. But please, again, thank the panel. And and thank you all very much.